to Cairo Nights. With the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, there's been a lot of discussion about who the president is going to nominate, when the president is going to nominate this person, and when a confirmation vote might happen in the U.S. Senate. But one of the other things that's happening as well is this discussion, this renewed discussion on a term called, or a procedure called packing the court. It is this idea of expanding the number of justices so you can create the majority that you want as opposed to the majority that maybe the opposing party wants. To explain what this is and the history behind it, we have Clark Lombardi from the University of Washington School of Law. Clark, when we talk about packing the court, what exactly are we talking about here?
Well, specifically, there's a set number of justices on the Supreme Court, but the number is set by law, and Congress can change the law. So it can, and over history, it has actually changed the number of justices who sit on the Supreme Court. It's been six, it's been five, it's been 10, and for a long period of time now, it's been nine. So packing the court would say that if you have a majority in the Congress and you don't like the decisions that are coming down from the justices who are the nine justices who are sitting on the Supreme Court, why don't you change the law and change the number of justices who sit on the court and arrange to have appointed justices who are more congenial?
And is this let me back up. So how would, if you're a sitting president and you've decided I want Supreme Court majority that works with my political bent, whose approval do you need to be able to expand the number of justices?
To appoint, if you want a justice appointed who is congenial to your legal outlook and your political philosophy, you need only the approval of the Senate. Appointments to a court require the consent and approval of the U.S. Senate, full stop. If you want to have a law change so that the number of justices who sit on the court is increased, then this has to go through the regular legislative process. So you're going to need bicameral approval and presentment, meaning you need both of the houses to approve and send you a bill that you sign, or if the two houses can get supermajorities, you don't even need to sign it.
And so obviously there's not going to be, I'm assuming there's not going to be any effort to pack the court if President Trump wins. He already has a significant majority in the court, one would assume, at that particular point. But there's been some pressure on the candidate, on former Vice President Biden, to actually consider this as a possibility. Some people think he should. Obviously, there's some Democrats who think he shouldn't. He would then need to get a bill through the House, which has a Democratic majority. He would need the Senate, essentially, I think, to flip, or at least get enough cross-party votes to move it through there so he could actually sign it. So a lot would have to actually change in the Senate and obviously in the presidency for this type of thing to move forward, correct?
Right. We would need to have, for Democrats to pack the court, they would need to win the presidency, keep the House, and win the Senate.
And so in this discussion, what is to be, I mean, I think I know what is to be gained, but I'll ask anyway, what is to be gained by packing the court and what is to be lost?
The question of what's to be gained, I mean, the question of what's to be gained would be, I suppose, if you believe that you can appoint justices who will, you can predict, they won't promise because it's considered an important convention that justices will not say in advance how they're going to vote. But usually based on a judge's past voting record, you can guess where they lean on issues that are important to you. And so what would to be gained by a president would be to be able to identify and seat justices who will either pull back from recent controversial decisions or maybe even overturn recent controversial decisions. And if you pack the court, you can get a majority to change the law. That's, in theory, what's to be gained. Now, in terms of what's to be lost, the court has worked very hard to maintain a nonpartisan reputation. Now, nonpartisan doesn't mean non-political, and it doesn't mean non-ideological. Justices come in with different approaches to interpretation, and they have different priorities and commitments, but they have really, really worked hard to avoid giving the impression that they vote in a way that Republicans like because they favor Republicans. And conversely, people who are on the liberal side work very hard to give the impression, and I think they genuinely believe this is true, that they are not voting consistently with Democratic perspectives simply because they're trying to curry favor with Democrats. Right. So the nonpartisan, you know, reputation of the court is really important. And that has helped the court mediate some pretty overwhelmingly difficult social problems in society, including the end of segregation in the South and a whole host of other issues. If you pack the court, it makes the court seem partisan, and even more. And already their polling suggests that people are coming to see the court as more partisan than they used to see the court. And if you pack the court, what you simply say is, I don't trust these people who were appointed by another party, so I'm going to pack it with people who I like, who are going to vote the way I vote. It's just going to increase the impression of the court as a primarily political, primarily partisan actor. And that could be enormously damaging to American democracy, because we're losing the neutral arbiter in really, really fierce political disputes and social disputes.
We're talking to Clark Lombardi, University of Washington School of Law, constitutional law expert. Clark, when we talk about then the number of justices, I think a lot of people think it's been frozen in time at 9 forever. It hasn't been. Can you tell us a little bit of the history of how many justices, I mean, over the course of time, how the court has expanded and also contracted?
Sure. The U.S. Constitution, Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution describes the federal judiciary, and it's incredibly short and incredibly open-ended. The U.S. Constitution says there will be one Supreme Court, and that there may be other courts if Congress wants to create them. That's pretty much what Article 3 says. And then Article 3 goes on to describe what the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court is, what cases have to be brought in the Supreme Court originally, and what cases can it hear on appeal from lower courts if those lower courts are created. The Article 3 does not describe this one Supreme Court that is going to exist. It doesn't say where, it doesn't say how many justices are going to be on it. So in the first Judiciary Act, when Congress first sat down under the new Constitution and tried to enact laws to create a judicial structure according to the very open-ended rules of the Constitution, they enacted the Civil Rights Act of 1789, which created a Supreme Court that had six justices on it. Okay. Very quickly, in part because of political disputes, Congress then turned around and in 1801 amended the Judiciary Act and actually took away one of the Supreme Court seats. So the Supreme Court, one of the justices had died, and the law was amended so that there would henceforth be only five justices. And then within a matter of less than a year, that law was repealed, and they went back to six justices. Now, then, as the country grew over the 19th century, the Judiciary Acts were repeatedly amended to increase the number of justices. And part of the reason was that justices used to have to go ride out to the different parts of the country and hear hear appeals as appellate judges, not as Supreme Court judges. They actually went down to assist appeals court judges. And as the country grew, you needed more justices to go fill that role of helping out the appellate judges around the country. So they've had up to 10 justices before the Civil or immediately after the Civil War. And then in the late 19th century, they finally settled on the number 9, and that's where we have been up to the present day, although at different times people have suggested the number should change. So it's really bounced around quite a bit.
And
usually it's bounced around for political reasons. So,
well,
go ahead.
And it sounds like then the other considerations, I'm not saying that they were free of politics, but it doesn't sound like it was an effort when it was being through the 19th century when it got to 9, that those other changes were not so much about trying to get a majority, but trying to just spread out the workload, essentially. Is that fair?
Well, that is fair in terms of why we're the number of judges increased. But you have to remember that at that time, before the Civil War, when new areas of the country were being admitted, the issue of slavery was hovering all over it. So when slave states were admitted, the new slave states wanted to be represented by their own justice. And so politics was always hovering around the debates about how many justices there should be and, of course, over who should sit in those seats.
We're talking with Clark Lombardi, University of Washington School of Law, expert on constitutional law, and apparently Supreme Court historian as well. Clark, what about this? Now, the one thing that gets cited frequently when you hear these news stories about packing the court and the history of it, it pretty much only goes back to, at least in the news stories, back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal. Can you tell us what happened then and why packing the court became a sort of a term of art at that particular moment?
Yeah, that was an interesting moment. And one reason that people, I think, focus on it is because the attempt failed. What had happened in the New Deal is that there were a number of justices on the Supreme Court who were used a very traditional, somewhat formalistic methodology for interpreting the Constitution. And their methodology, which was considered to be sort of old-fashioned and very formal, led them to overrule a lot of the New Deal legislation. So the Supreme Court had been sitting around working more or less effectively with its 9 justices. And then when Franklin Roosevelt came into power and started enacting a number of quite radical laws, and laws that really did push the boundaries of what at that time had been considered constitutionally acceptable. And a lot of the justices on the court then, a majority of the justices, said, no, you've gone too far. There are a whole number of ways in which you have brought rulemaking into the executive. You're allowing the executive branch to make rules instead of having Congress make laws. You are regulating activities that used to be regulated by the states and that arguably the Constitution says should be regulated by the states. And so we're not going to permit you to do that. We're going to strike those laws down. And Roosevelt was outraged, I mean, absolutely outraged. And his plan came to be, he looked at this and he said, you know, all the justices who are striking down my laws are older. So I'm going to come up with a plan where I will increase the size of the court so that I will appoint new younger justices who will be, and I get to appoint them, and I have a huge majority in Congress, so they're going to get through. And these justices will vote to uphold all of my new legislation. And if I get enough of them, then they're going to get majorities. They're going to overwhelm the conservative dissenters. So that was his plan. Now, two things happened. I mean, one is that there was actually real resistance to the idea that the court should be increased simply for the purpose, for the nakedly political purpose of overruling decisions that had been reached in good faith by these conservative justices. Even Democrats, members of Roosevelt's party, were concerned about this. And so they resisted. And at the same time, this conservative bloc of justices, at least one of them, began to change his votes. And we don't know why. Was it because he really didn't want to be packed and swept up of the court? Did he believe it was better to make a compromise and keep the current group of justices on the court rather than be swept away by a group of young Turks? It's unclear. But so these two things happened at the same time. One is that one of the justices began to vote to uphold the New Deal legislation, which allowed it to survive. And at the same time, a lot of Democrats said, please, isn't there some other way that we can accomplish what we want? And in the wake of those two things, President Roosevelt stepped back from his plan to increase the number of justices and to pack the court with a number of new, younger justices who would overwhelm the older ones. So that is the court packing plan in the 1930s.
Since then, has this threat come up from time to time, or is it pretty much it kind of was laid to rest then, and only recently did it come back as some sort of idea on how to tilt a majority in favor of president and, I guess, Congress, should they be all from the same party?
Well, you know, that history is sort of taught as an interesting something that tells us something interesting about U.S. government and about the court. And one of them is that people want the courts to be non-political and to be stable. So they don't want court personnel to be changing overnight on the basis of who sits in the political office. The courts are supposed to be independent of the political branches, and people in the U.S. seem to like that. So that's one takeaway that people had from the court packing, the court packing moment, the court packing threat in the Depression. The other thing that people take away from it involves this unexplained, somewhat telling shift in voting patterns by at least one of the justices, which is to say that the court is aware that if you go too far, and justices on the court seem to be aware that if they go too far, if they push too far and start issuing opinions that are too far out of what most Americans, mainstream Americans, feel to be reasonable, then all sorts of bad things can happen. Among them, the Congress could pack the courts to basically silence their votes. Another thing that could happen, which we haven't talked about, is Congress has the ability to strip the Supreme Court of jurisdiction to hear cases. Congress has the right to tell the Supreme Court, you cannot hear a certain type of case. We're just so fed up with the way you decide these cases that you can't hear it. That's explicitly in the Constitution. And justices are aware, not only I could just suddenly wake up with 20 new colleagues I didn't want who are going to outvote me all the time if I go too far. Or Congress could tell me, that's it. You can't hear gun rights cases, or we're done. You can't hear religious freedom cases. In theory, that's possible. And so judges themselves tend to moderate. And some people have suggested that some of the recent decisions and opinions written by Justice Roberts reflect a concern that if the court goes too far, then someone is going to suggest either packing the courts or stripping jurisdiction. So it's always hovering around in the background. But one reason it's really never shown up since the Depression is both people realize that this is extreme, and courts understand that if they push things too far, someone could try it. So everyone's been compromising. But President Trump and, to some extent, Majority Leader McConnell just don't seem to be real compromisers. They're really willing to push the envelope and see whether their aggressively partisan attempt to appoint judges with quite distinctive views, and views that are probably outside the mainstream of at least most of the legal class, if not of most of Americans. But they're willing to see whether really systematically appointing judges with this quite distinctive legal philosophy will in fact provoke the kind of extreme reaction that Franklin Roosevelt's attempt to do the same thing in the 30s. Provoked, and it looks like it might.
That is Clark Lombardi, University of Washington law professor and expert on constitutional law. Clark, thank you very much for joining Cairo Nights.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Mike.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Earlier in the show, I talked about how Maine, we focused on Maine once before when we were talking about Susan Collins last week. Maine is again in the news from voting in a very interesting way. This is an idea that you may have heard about. It's not been well explained in many cases, but we're going to try to help get some help explaining it tonight. It's called ranked voting, and Maine is going to be in this election cycle the first ever state to use ranked voting. Joining us right now is Mark Allen Smith, a political science professor at the University of Washington, who is here to walk us through what exactly is ranked voting, what does it do better than the current system, and maybe does it not do quite as well. Mark, thank you for joining us on Cairo Nights.
Sure thing. Thanks for inviting me.
So what is, before we get into Maine's specific thing, what is ranked voting? And how does your vote, how does your ballot look if you are doing ranked voting in an election?
Your ballot would look roughly the same as it would under the kind of system we have in Washington. The difference would be that instead of, say, coloring in a box, you would have a place like maybe there's a line and you would write in numbers, or maybe there would be boxes where there would be like a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you would color in a 1, a 2, a 3, 4, or a 5 for each candidate. So the idea is if there's more than one candidate in a race, or I suppose more than two really, then you might prefer, you know, candidate A to candidate B, but candidate B to candidate C. Ordinarily, if you just are picking one, you just list your top choice and then you're done. With ranked choice voting, you actually go through sequentially through all the candidates and you just quite literally rank them. Now, you don't have to do a full ranking. Just like right now, if we get to a certain race that's on the ballot, maybe you haven't paid much attention to the county commissioner race. There's nothing that says you have to fill in a bubble for that race. You can always leave it blank.
Right.
With ranked choice voting, you can rank as many candidates as there are, but you don't have to use that full choice. You could just list your first choice and be done. But if there's five candidates running, you could say, this is my number one, this is my number two, this is my three, this is my four, and this is my five.
And then, all right, so you do that, and then that goes back to the election office. How is that then tallied? I mean, how does somebody then end up winning that election?
Well, a lot of times it ends up being pretty easy. If someone gets a majority of the first place votes, you're done. And that can happen if there's, you know, kind of a clear favorite in a certain race. But suppose you don't have a majority winner with just first place votes. Suppose the first place votes are kind of split up between, in this hypothetical example we're working with, say five candidates. Maybe one candidate has, you know, 40%, somebody else has 30, somebody else has 28, and someone else has 12, and somebody else has 5. I think those would sum to approximately 100. I'm just making this up off the top of my head. So what you would do is, at that point, no one has a majority, right? The top vote getter had 40%. So what you do is you sequentially lop off the least popular candidate, and then now they're out. And then effectively you have another round of voting, but you actually have all that information already on the ballot. So you go to people's, for everyone whose candidates are still alive, you just keep their first place votes. But whoever voted for that candidate who is now eliminated, you go to their second choice votes. And their second choice votes get reallocated among the remaining candidates according to those individual voters' preferences. So now you have all of the first place votes for the candidates remaining. And then for whoever got eliminated, the people who chose that person, now you're going to their second choice. So you could see how if someone, in my hypothetical example, they were at 40, but suppose someone was like, you know, at 48 or 49, like they were pretty close, with that second round reallocation, maybe now they're over the threshold and they get to 50. But it could sometimes happen, depending upon how the split is, the person who was leading after the first round of voting might not be leading after the second. So suppose we have a candidate out there that some people really like, but they don't, people really hate. So this person gets a good number of first choice votes, but they don't get many second place votes because you either love them or you hate them.
Yeah, a polarized candidate, right.
They're polarized candidate. Meanwhile, there's somebody else who's not quite as popular in terms of first place choices, but a fair number of people like that person pretty well as their second choice vote. Well, once some of the candidates start getting eliminated and you reallocate those second choice votes, that person who wasn't quite as popular on the first round of voting, they can end up prevailing in one of the later rounds.
And so when this happens, and just to recap, we're talking to Mark Allen Smith. He's a political science professor at the University of Washington. We're talking about this idea of ranked voting because Maine is going to experiment with it for the first time in U.S. history this election cycle. And it's effectively a way to sort of allow not a winner-take-all voting structure, but essentially if a whole bunch of people like somebody a fair bit that can actually win the day as much as, you know, maybe just 51% of the people liking somebody a lot and a lot of other people hating him. Is it fair to say that the strength of this is it can create a compromise candidate out of a ballot situation?
Yes, that's certainly one of the possible effects, is that it can create someone who's more broadly acceptable. I like to think of it not as necessarily a replacement for winner take all, because at the end of the day, you're still electing one person.
Right,
there is
right.
still
Fair
a
enough.
Winner who
yeah.
is going to take all. But you're shifting from plurality to majority. So if you have multiple candidates running and the votes are split, you can have a plurality winner who's not a majority winner. When you do ranked choice voting, as you sequentially eliminate candidates, eventually you get to a place where somebody has a majority. And that's a part of what creates in some instances, a compromised candidate. And another thing it does is it gives more encouragement for third parties. So in this country, we famously have a primarily two-party system. But then there are all these third parties out there, and depending upon what state you're in and who qualifies for the ballot and so on, you'll often have, in certain races, a number of other choices. It's just most people don't really want to vote for those choices because, first of all, those candidates don't get that much attention during the campaign. And then you might think, well, they have no chance of winning, so why do I want to, quote, waste my vote on a third-party candidate who can't win? That's a problem with our current system. And so effectively, you end up with two choices. Even if there's more than two listed on the ballot, kind of everybody knows, really, you have two choices. When you do ranked choice voting, if you really prefer a third-party candidate, you can go ahead and vote for them because it's not a wasted vote. If they end up being one of the candidates who gets eliminated through this sequential process, no problem. You get reallocated to your second choice vote. So in a way, with ranked choice voting, you can kind of go with who you really want and not have to worry about this strategic calculation of, well, do I really want to go for somebody who has no chance of winning?
That makes sense. So do you think that, I mean, is there a possibility that this would actually change the nature of politics itself? I mean, if I knew that I could go out there and just be everyone's second best, everyone's second favorite, it might change the dynamics of a political race. It might change the dynamics of the language that I use. I mean, is that sort of what potentially could happen here? Or is that just, you know, more theoretical and politics probably wouldn't change a whole lot under a ranked choice voting system?
Well, I think we have to be careful with any political reform not to overpromise, because we have a lot of political difficulties in this country and there's a lot of, you know, potential reforms out there, and it's important not to overpromise. Having said that, there's a lot of instances of ranked choice voting, not at the federal level, but for, say, city races or in some instances some state races. And then that, of course, gives us a chance to study the results of those and how are the campaigns different and so on. And the political scientists who've studied that, they do find that the campaign changes, because if it's just a pure plurality, you know, you just want to, it doesn't really matter if you're polarizing. You just need the most first place votes.
Right.
But once you have a ranked choice voting system, it's not as advantageous to be polarizing because you really need some of those second place votes too. So it does tend to lead to a campaign that's a little less divisive, because rather than just like attacking all the other candidates, you kind of want to, if there's some other candidates who's close to you, you don't want to just destroy them. You want their supporters to think like, well, okay, maybe they prefer that person to you, but you want them to list you as their next choice. So it does change how the campaign unfolds. And it also gives voters more choices. So right now, there's a fair number of people out there who don't, frankly, care all that much for either political party. They might prefer one to the other, but they're not all that excited about their own party. And if you have ranked choice voting, all these third party candidates right now who have a tough time getting attention, all of a sudden they do start to get more attention. In some instances, maybe they win, but even if they don't win, people can be turned out to vote for them, and then people don't have to worry about throwing their vote away, because then you always have this next round of the, if their favorite candidate gets eliminated, then you go on to their second choices.
That was Mark Allen Smith, a professor of political science at the University of Washington. The subject was ranked choice voting, and Maine, it turns out, is going to be the first ever state to use ranked choice voting for a presidential election. Mark, thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Yeah, sure thing, Mike. Thanks for inviting me.
Coming up, we'll be talking to Stacey Joe after the break at the top of the hour. A little bit of wrap-up on the Seahawks, a lot of wrap-up on another big controversy in sports reporting. Yes, somebody wrote another bad piece objectifying women sports reporters, and we weigh in on that after the break at the top of the hour. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. This is where we battle with the Questrotron 700, whether or not we can answer its questions in a timely fashion with some measure of intelligence. Often I fail. Frank, Shane, they do much better than I do. They're much better at this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So the first question goes to Shane. Shane, wait, hold it, wait, hold it. Let's do the sound. There we go. What is the most depressing meal you've eaten?
Wow. The most depressing meal? I don't think I could pinpoint an exact meal, but I know that my first year of moving away from home, living in good old Craig Hall in Chico, California, when I was going to school there, I only ate pizza the whole entire first year, because any time that I tried anything else, I would get sick almost. So I just stuck with the pizza pie the whole entire year.
All right, Frank.
Pretty good. My freshman year was at Carleton College, Northfield, Minnesota, in the dining hall, the main dining hall. And they used to serve something we just called beige foam. It sort of had the consistency of pudding or Jell-O. Swear to God, it had little bubbles in it, and it was beige.
What does beige taste like?
I never tasted it, and nobody would touch it. It scared the crap out of all of us.
That's great. So mine is, this is one that I just thought of. So I guess the most depressing one was when I was in the Yosemite jail briefly under they had falsely identified me as a felon,
no,
arrested me in front of my new girlfriend, hauled me into jail. And then when they saw my press card and other ID, they realized, oh, I was not the person that they were looking for. But they did actually leave. They took away my belt and my shoes, as they do when you're
right
in jail. And I had like a cliff. We were going hiking. I had like a cliff bar in my pocket. So I would say sitting in the Yosemite jail, eating a cliff bar was like, you know, one of the worst meals I'd had in a long time. All right.
Yikes.
Let's see what else we got for the Questrotron right now. Frank,
yes.
What do you regret not doing or starting when you were younger?
Oh, God, make a long list.
Yeah, just pick one.
Well, okay. I've always been an admirer of great comic book artists, and I would have been very, very interested in maybe studying how to do that.
Right.
And actually see if I could do it. I know I could do it. I just would have needed to study for it. I never did. Made other choices. That's okay. But it would have been an interesting life.
Shane, you're still pretty young, so you can still actually listen to Frank and maybe not make the same decisions.
Well, if I had to choose anything, I would probably say I wish I started football a little bit earlier, which is kind of, you know, kind of crazy to think about because of all the CTE and some of the bad health things that come along with playing football.
But you dug it?
I loved playing football. It was huge in my small town, and I was always second string behind a lot of the guys that played when they were really, really little and had a few
Pop Warner kids, right?
The Pop Warner kids. I started a little later, so I always kind of wish that I was able to have a little bit more of an opportunity carrying the ball and playing some football.
Yeah. All right. That's actually a good one. You know what I wish I had done was I wish I'd retained this from being a kid. So my mom didn't speak English till she was probably 17 or so. Okay. Actually, maybe 15. And all of her relatives, she's Panamanian, all of her relatives, we'd go down to visit the family down there. And I was pretty fluent in Spanish as a kid and kept up with it pretty good in California. And then just as an adult, and especially moving up here 20 years ago, it's just drifted away.
It's gone.
And it's just a drag because it's so handy to have. It's so great. And now my Spanish is not, my accent is good. My Spanish is marginal, mainly because I can't think under pressure. Like sometimes if I'm relaxed and I'm not, but if someone's asking me a question immediately, you know, I get reflexively panicked and my language has completely gone away from me, which is a supreme drag. All right. Let's see if we got time for, I think we got time for one more real quick one. Okay, this is the lightning round. What is the most underrated or overrated TV show? Am I first on this one?
Sure.
All right, I'll go first. Overrated TV show, Westworld, which I actually still really enjoy, but I feel like it's overrated. Underrated TV show, The John Oliver Show, which I think is phenomenal. I think that is like repertorial comedy. I like it a lot. Frank?
Underrated show, Blue Bloods on CBS, the Tom Selleck cop show. Just week in, week out, great acting, great stories, just really fun. Overrated show, just about anything on the reality show circuit. So let's just pick arbitrarily Love Island. Dear God.
One of Stacey Joe Ross' favorite
shows. Is it really?
Shame?
Oh, my.
I would say the most overrated TV show of all time is Friends. I hate Friends. I do not like it at all.
I'm with you on that one.
Friends is overrated. And then most underrated, I'd have to probably maybe go with Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Some people throw some hate towards that show, but that show's fabulous.
It is a great show. All right, that's all the time we have tonight for the Random Question Robot. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in the next hour, it's going to be Stacey Joe Rost, lover of Love Island, who is going to talk Seahawks and yet another mistake somebody made while criticizing the people they shouldn't be criticizing in the world of professional sports. Announcing right after the break.